CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, there's going to be a big White House meeting, including Republicans, on the president's jobs plan. But I keep reading these reports, apparently from reputable economists, that spending all this money actually means we lose a million jobs. Can you explain that?
Well, I mean, it is hard to imagine, but let's think of it as a near term, medium term, long term. So in the near term, I don't think there's going to be a lot of changes to the whole job situation because the government can't spend money all that fast. So near term, I'm meaning like in the next year or so, no change to the jobs. And by the way, as we learned from Chair Jerome Powell on 60 Minutes last night, the economy is already turning around. Things are accelerating. We are probably going to see all the jobs that were basically vaporized by the pandemic. We're going to see some form of them or different kinds of jobs that basically will get back to the same labor force by next year. Okay, great. That's near term. Intermediate term. So you start spending money and yeah, there's some jobs that are created and that's all well and good. But remember, the whole idea is that you're spending money over an 8-year time horizon, the government is, and they're paying for it over 15 years. And one of the ways that they're suggesting we pay for it, or the main way, is through corporate taxes. And so the concept of like what's going to happen with jobs is really the push-pull between the spending on the plan itself and the tax rate going up for companies who might slow down their hiring, And that we don't know. And so, you know, I've seen estimates where the job creation number is basically a little bit, you know, sort of better, like up a million. Then I've seen the same thing that you've seen, which is down a million. And then somewhere in between, it seems to me that it's sort of like it may net not turn into lots of new jobs, but we still should do the spending because we have been underinvesting for decades.
Well, it sounds like maybe it's different kinds of jobs. So, for example, you might not be able to hire as many software engineers, but you hire more construction workers. And actually, for my money, my iPhone is smart enough. It's I don't need to try any harder to complete my text messages for me. What I would like is to see some smoother roads with actually, you know, with visible lane markings.
Think about it. Same as your house, right? You know, if you think about spending on things in your house or in your life, there are certain things that you want to spend money on that do make your life easier, safer, better, right? And so it doesn't really matter to me. I agree with you that, you know, whether this is the roads, but it is also broadband. It is also the idea that, you know, why is it that we don't really have good workforce retraining? Why is it that we have been lagging on research and development? I think the one area that's really fascinating to me is this idea of spending for caregivers. And I did a little bit of a deep dive myself to try to understand how we make the leap from those things that like we want to do that are really good for our house, right? The bones of the house. And then what seems like a cosmetic thing, but maybe it's not a cosmetic thing, right? And I think that when we look at that one area of spending for the caregivers, $400 billion, the way it's being explained to me, at least from economists, is that that's what's called human infrastructure. Have you ever heard that term?
Well, lately I have, yes.
It's fascinating to me. I had not really, like, I had heard of, you know, obviously human capital, which is like the way that we explain our work lives, like that we have a lot to do with creating the ability to earn income just by investing in ourselves. Human infrastructure, again, an investment in human beings and the health, the education, the welfare of human beings. This was actually first done after World War II. So there is something called the GI Bill. And the GI Bill was, hey, how are we going to spend money on these guys who fought in a war, and how are we going to bring them back into society and make them more productive? And the GI Bill created a lot of spending on making education and trade schools tuition free, which also gave low interest mortgages, healthcare, VA system created then. And so all of that was done to help this very specific group of people, the veterans. And a similar way of thinking about the $400 billion in this bill is really just targeting a different population, the elderly and the disabled. The populations and those groups just decimated, frankly, by the pandemic. So what will we spend to make their lives better? And do we think that that's worthwhile? We used to think we thought about that. Yes, yes, for the veterans. does the American public think that that's necessary for the elderly and the disabled?
You could also argue that if you want people to come back to work, they need someone many times to take care of their elderly parents and daycare for their children. Otherwise,
yeah, it's fascinating, though. You know, like when you hear this is what this is actually the slippery slope that I find with many things. So just like with corporate America, there are times where it drives me nuts when they're like, well, let's make the business case for having equality. Mm-hmm. Well, no, let's make the actual moral case for doing it, right? Yeah. And it's very slippery because you could say that actually an investment in child care or early childhood education, that investment pays off over time because those kids are better equipped to manage their lives. They become more productive. And so there's a return on that investment. What's the return on the investment to helping an 85-year-old have five more dignified years? It's not very good when you think of it as an investment, but as a moral case, I think it's very good.
Along those lines, what's the message from the Amazon vote where the union did not win? Is this the final in the coffin of the union movement?
It does not look good for the union movement. It's interesting, though, right? Amazon did have a very good case to make. Hey, we are paying twice the level of the minimum wage in your area, right? The question I keep asking myself, and maybe I'm just a dope and that's why, you know, I'm not Jeff Bezos, but if you are, you know, one of the two or three richest companies in the world, why not spend the money, instead of spending all that money fighting against unionization, why not make conditions like great where you are and make a tiny bit less money, let's say profitability, or give a little bit less money back to the shareholders and say, like, I want to make this the best place in the country to work. Why not do that? I don't get it.
Well, usually, in my experience anyway, companies do that when there's a threat of unionization. It's sort of like healthcare, right? A pharmaceutical company is going to charge you as much as they can unless you start talking about regulating them, and then they pull back. So, all right, maybe the union loses this time, but you always have to keep the threat there, don't you?
Well, I think that unions do a good job of making sure that workplace conditions are strong and that workers are protected. And I think that it's a bit dangerous to just quantify the working life as just pay, because people do say, yes, of course I want to get paid, but I want to be treated well. So I think that having the threat of unionization may be okay, but I think that for these big companies, the takeaway is if you have some really good targeted messaging and you keep the hourly rate at a decent level, no one's going to unionize.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. There's an article in an outlet called Stat News, which covers healthcare news, about Pfizer working on not just a vaccine here. Of course, they've already got approval for that, but a pill that you could give to somebody who already has COVID-19. Let's call in the doctor.
Patient Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. And this pill is in clinical trials right now. And since you're a trained pharmacologist, this effort to develop a pill has been going on for a long time now, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's really important that we first understand, why do we even need a pill? Some people may say, well, look, we've got the vaccines and now we've got three vaccines. We might have a fourth. If we have vaccines and they're able to prevent us from getting the illness or reduce the severity of the illness, then what do we need a pill for? But the fact of the matter is, we all know that not everybody's going to get a vaccine, and there will be people who will get sick. We also know that the vaccine is not 100% effective, and so some people will get sick irrespective of being vaccinated. So, as with most things, we need some sort of simple, low-cost pill that we can basically hand to people who are sick, and they'll get better. Now, everybody's familiar with antibiotics. I mean, in the era pre-antibiotics, people used to get bacterial infections and die from them. But then antibiotics came, and we were able to then give people antibiotics and treat bacterial infections. And for years now, people worked, not only did we have the flu vaccine, but people worked on developing a pill for flu. And so many people will be familiar with the drug Tamiflu, and Tamiflu is a drug that can be given to people who have an infection with influenza virus. But the problem is, oftentimes, these antiviral medications aren't that effective. And in some ways, it's sort of the panacea of medicine to develop an effective antiviral drug that we really don't have for any virus right now. So this information that's coming out about this new drug from Pfizer that is an antiviral drug is encouraging. But in all honesty, there's probably not any virus right now that we treat solely with a single antiviral medication. Usually it's a cocktail of a variety of different things.
One of the things that we're being told, of course, is that we'll have to probably get an annual COVID vaccine now. And a lot of people, of course, are just vaccine averse for whatever reason. And it strikes me as if you had a pill, at least for people like that, it would provide some sort of security, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, actually, you and I started talking about this early on, right? Long before there was a vaccine, we started talking about, well, a vaccine may get to the point where it helps. But if we look at the statistics from flu vaccinations, about 40% of Americans get the flu vaccine every year, which means 60% are not. You know, a pill would help with those people who choose not to get vaccinated. If we require an annual COVID vaccine, people are all anxious to get it right now because they understand the severity of it. And they also understand the implications of getting vaccinated so we can reopen our economy, get kids back to school, get people back to work and whatnot. But as time goes on, interest in getting a COVID vaccine booster may not carry the same weight that it does right now. So a pill is really important. And it's a real challenge, by the way, to develop an antiviral pill because there's a lot of challenges that pharmacologists, scientists face. So first, the scientists have to actually find some vulnerability within the virus itself. And oftentimes they have to screen literally hundreds of thousands of drugs to actually find a few that could potentially latch onto that target. But one of the things that's different about a virus rather than a bacteria is an organism that lives on its own and we can give a drug that attacks it and kills it. But a virus doesn't work that way. A virus actually takes over our own cells and uses the machinery within our own cells to replicate itself. So we have to find a target that's vulnerable to the virus itself, but not also going to harm the host, i.e. us, or our own cells as part of that target. So it's far more complicated to develop an antiviral drug. And look, it's sort of an interesting thing that, you know, the common cold is the common cold for a reason. It's common. Half the common colds are caused by coronaviruses. And we still don't have a pill to treat the common cold now after, you know, decades and decades and decades of research. And literally billions and billions of dollars of research, we don't have that cure. So now we're saying, well, here's a unique novel coronavirus, the one that's causing COVID, and we need to suddenly, with urgency, develop that drug that's going to wipe out the coronavirus without wiping us out at the same time. It's a real challenge.
So with the Pfizer pill in clinical trials and Merck about to start, what kind of timeline are we talking about before we see one of these at the drugstore?
You know, again, we got a vaccine in under a year. If these drugs prove in a clinical trial to be effective, we could see them on the market and available in pharmacies or doctor's offices in under a year.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
The legislative session in Olympia is winding down, so let's take a look at what lawmakers have accomplished. Let's go to Car Radio's Hannah Scott on the passage of more police accountability measures. Hannah.
That's right. This was a big cutoff period on Sunday that really everything had to be passed out of its house of origin in order to be able to make it to the end of the line. And that led to a lot of bills being passed over the weekend. And one of them was the use of force, allowable use of force for police officers. And this does a great many things. Essentially, what it does is expand on I-940 and define what force is acceptable to be, like kind of lays out specifics for what force and when it can be used, creates a civil standard for the use of force. And it has to be, you can only use deadly force when there is an imminent threat of bodily harm or death to the officer or another person. Physical use of force is very similar, but it also includes the threat of danger to both yourself, the officer, any citizen, and then the person you're going to use the force against. It lays out that you need to de-escalate, and de-escalation tactics can be your verbal commands or things that you say to the person. It can include leaving the scene if there's no crime actually going on. So it's kind of like we've talked about in the protests that we've seen, where if they come and they're all in the riot gear, that escalates the situation. So removing yourself as the officer to avoid that. It says you have to go through all of those things. And then, and only then, are you allowed to use the deadly use of force. And Democratic Senator Jamie Peterson with the Law and Justice Committee explained why this was important.
The community of family members and survivors, people who have advocated for reform and for justice in this area, have brought us this bill because they have observed that the reforms that the people requested in passing Initiative 940 have not been quite sufficient to the task, and that we continue to witness incidents of excessive force deployed by our officers.
Now, he also explained that laying out the specific rules would actually be better for officers.
We want to empower officers to do the right thing. We want to give them guidance about the standards that we expect them to uphold. And this is a carefully nuanced bill that will provide that guidance to our law enforcement officers about our expectations for them as they do their best every day to try to do justice and uphold the laws that we pass in this body.
Republican Doug Erickson warned,
the people will be less safe because law enforcement officers will not be able to take the steps that many people who pick up the phone and dial 911 would like those law enforcement officers to take.
But Democratic Senator David Frog took issue with that framing.
This bill does not prevent the use of force when it's necessary. It lays out some parameters, but it certainly is not intending to prevent police officers from protecting us, protecting anyone else. I think that we need to be specific in our language as we debate this bill and others that may come up.
But perhaps the most powerful moment came with an amendment that was offered by Republican Senator Mike Patton that would have allowed the limited use of tear gas for riots and hostage situations. Democrat Peterson was quick to urge the no vote.
Tear gas is banned in wartime. It is not a tool that our police need to be able to use on peaceful protesters, or frankly, on any protesters, even if someone has decided that there's a riot situation.
That's when fellow Democrat Steve Hobbs, fresh from his National Guard duty stint, showed up with a warning.
I have been there. I have been there facing a crowd of hundreds with just a few people. And not having that non-lethal capability, not having it is a recipe for disaster. When you have thousands of people in one area, there is going to be an element that wants to be violent when you have that many people around. As it gets worse and worse and worse, and you have no means to control the violence if it gets out of the hand, then you need to have non-lethal capability. Having the use of tear gas or puts another level before the use of lethal force.
And that was enough, his speech, to move enough people. They didn't give the vote count because it was an amendment to move enough people. And that was added into the bill, the allowance of tear gas when necessary to deal with a riot. And but the bill itself, the overall bill that lays out this use of force policy, did pass barely 26-23 because Hobbs and another Democrat moved over to the other side.
So, in other words, Democrat, at least part of the Democratic Party, understands that there may be some situations where it actually saves lives to deploy tear gas.
Absolutely. And that's what you were hearing there from Senator Hobbs, who, again, is National Guard. He served in Bosnia. He's been in that situation. And really, more than once, that was, he did that on the floor, but he also gave a similar speech last week to really try to move the needle on it. And he was successful.
Okay.
The other one quickly that I'll mention is the independent investigations. This was, remember, kind of the heart of it all when we first started. The governor had a task force because the families of police have issues with the way that some of the investigations of deadly use of force have gone lately. And this is Senator Jamie Peterson again saying that the new office was about those families of those killed by police.
This is an important step toward justice, toward healing, toward reconciliation, and toward reestablishing confidence in our police.
And what this does is create an Office of Independent Investigations within the governor's office, and it would have a director that they eventually hire, but that would be decided by an advisory panel board. On the advisory panel, there's like 11 members. You have a family member of someone killed by police, three regular civilians, mental health expert, prosecutor, defense attorney, some law enforcement representatives, all working together towards this. The big concern for Republicans was that this was being created within the governor's office.
To have it in a political office, regardless of who the governor is, there's going to be political pressures.
There's a distrust because of this.
There's a couple of interesting nuggets in this bill as passed. One is that it could possibly allow, the way it's written, for retroactive investigations into other police deadly use of force cases that have already been supposedly investigated.
Really?
Yes, if there's new evidence. So this still has to go back for a concurrence vote. That's the way it's worded now. They could try to change that in the House when it goes back to that vote, but it looks to me that that's possibly going to be included. Also, the big push was, you know, the families don't trust cops to investigate other cops. That's always been the deal. And I was surprised when I read it to see that there it allows for former officers, as long as they haven't worked as a cop for the last 2 years, to be on the investigation team. And I asked a family member of someone in Seattle who's lost a loved one to police use of force, are you upset about that? Because she was on this task force with the governor's. And she said no, they were happy with it because there's a provision in the bill that has it transitioned to all civilian investigators in 5 years that Republicans tried to change, but that's the way it's worded right now.
Well, then, so it sounds like this is approaching a consensus where the families and legislators are on the same page. What about police unions? Have they weighed in on this?
Police unions are not, most of them are not on board. I believe you had possibly Fraternal Order of Police worked on this and the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs. I think we're on board. This, remember, came from the task force that the governor had created almost a year ago now that had those family members and those law enforcement representatives.
Yeah.
So I think this is kind of like I-940 where everybody pitched in together and you didn't hear a lot of rhetoric and pushback from the Republicans. Again, just that it was in the governor's office and some concerns about that retroactivity.
Well, good. That's progress then.
That's progress.
Yep. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. Can you believe it? It's been nearly 5 years of the Daily Dose of Kindness. It's a quest to bring you that kindness each morning at this time. My hope is that it has inspired you to at least look for the good in each day. Perhaps some of you, it may have inspired you to an act of kindness. But even if you haven't, I understand it can be difficult to know where to start, how to take that first step, be vulnerable. It is hard to be vulnerable. Well, CBS's Steve Hartman can help you with that, introducing us to a young boy who shows that any act of kindness or bravery has to start from within.
13-year-old William Olmsted says to build strong character, you need to step outside your comfort zone. So he did just that.
You went outside your comfort zone.
Quite literally, yes.
Quite literally, yes.
William is a Boy Scout, loved camping until COVID came along. So he thought, what better way to challenge himself than to put a tent up behind his house in Wilton, Connecticut, and sleep in it longer than any backyard camper ever has.
Every night?
Yes.
Yeah, a year and a day.
William's dad, Bill.
You know, stopping him from doing anything is a fool's errand.
So William's parents went along with it. Let him give up his warm, cozy bed in exchange for howling coyotes and bitter cold. Blizzards, sweltering heat, and worse.
I want to give you a chance to defend your parenting here. A hurricane went through at one point.
Yes.
And you let him stay outside.
Yeah, that night we also put the tent under the deck to protect from the wind.
And how many trees did you lose that day?
We lost six.
And how many sons?
None that we know of.
In Bill's defense, the bulk of the storm had passed by nightfall, and William is a hurricane in his own right.
If I start something, I have to finish it, and if I don't finish it, I'd be so upset.
Parents often push their kids, but it moves them no closer to success.
You ready to be tucked in?
Yes.
Because the prod has to come from within.
Good dreams.
Good dreams.
William was determined to sleep outside a full year, and this week, he made it. His next goal? To end world hunger. Doesn't know how yet, but you can bet tonight, he's sleeping on it. Steve Hartman, on the road, in Wilton, Connecticut.
What I took away from this is I can't make you be kind, but hopefully the prod comes from within at some point.
Great story. And now it's 7:49 from the G and Ursula Show, which begins at 9 o'clock here on Cairo Radio. Here is G. Scott joining us from Pierce County.
Hey!
Where you may be facing a rollback. How do you feel about that?
No. Governor Jay Inslee, if you listening, fam, don't do it. Don't do it, and here's why. Now, as someone who is currently sitting down, and I'm on lockdown because your boy got COVID. I'm doing okay, I'm doing okay. But at the same time, this is not the time to punish those that are A, doing the right thing, and B, that are trying to truly make money. What we have gone through over the last year has been catastrophic for some businesses and for those that are in the working world. They haven't been able to make money, and right now is just not the time to do it. I think it would be.
So what's he supposed to do? Because if he doesn't, that means he's going back on his word, and you know, it's like a parent. If you say there's going to be a punishment for doing something, you got to follow through. Otherwise, you get taken advantage of. So
no, I need him to learn from this right here. I need him to be understanding. I need him to actually recognize that, hey, just because people in your family will be fine does not mean that other people in the state of Washington will be fine. In particular, since we're talking about Pierce County, we're talking about that. Look, I'm going to be fine, guys. I'm going to be fine. You guys are going to be fine. We talking on the radio. We're going to be fine. But there's businesses right now that was like, look, they will not be able to make it. The one thing about COVID is this. It has to be eradicated at some point, right? Like, that's the goal in the future. Well, that's not going to happen in April, and it's not going to happen in May. Just to let everyone know, COVID's going to be here for a little bit because of the whatever the reason is, a slow response, or however the case might be. It's out there. It's here. But at the same time, do not punish these businesses. Yes, there is an uptick in cases. We understand that.
I think the governor has to start looking at death rates because, yes, there's been an uptick in cases, but death numbers are not rising. They're staying. Now, listen, we are still losing souls. That much is true. We are still losing people to this disease, but not at a rate that we were at the beginning, and a large part of that is because the most at-risk population is vaccinated.
We're in April. We're over a year into this. There's not what most people know, like you're talking about, Colleen. Most people know that COVID's real, right? They understand the protocols that they have to take. When you go out in public, you see people, they're wearing their mask. You see people go to a restaurant, they're wearing their mask. Everybody's trying to do what they can. There's a very small percentage of people in this country that just like, you know what, I don't care. But for everybody else, they care. These businesses out there, they care. Do not punish these businesses. And I got to tell you, I will be very disappointed in the governor if he rolls back and goes back to phase two. Dave, you haven't commented. Your thoughts?
Well, I had my say. I mean, the problem we're getting to now is this is getting to be like group punishment. So the people who are doing the right thing are going to be punished because some people didn't. And if you're going to, the rational way to do this now, it seems to me, is to find out how these things are spreading and address those hotspots. But I think the blanket shutdowns have run their course. They've had their effectiveness, and people are out of patience with that because it affects those who
didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
They're following all the rules. Well, that's not enough because your neighbors didn't follow the rules.
Right.
And I think people are past that. They're not going to go down
yeah.
to that.
I'm hoping the Governor Jay Inslee really over the weekend, maybe he's got a few phone calls from someone. He's like, hey, look, Jay, I see what you're trying to do, but that's not the right thing to do. I know what you said. Sometimes you just got to get to the point where you just say, you know what? I was going to do this, but I'm starting to get a better understanding. People will have more respect for you there. Now, don't get me wrong. There's nothing Governor Jay can do in some people's eyes that will be favorable. Well, this one right here, this is your time right now to act as a governor and actually relate to the majority of the people in this state. And the majority of the people are saying, come on now, don't roll us back. And that would be that time.
Yeah. Ooh, I like a fired up G.
Yep. Yep. Some point, you know the consequences and you got to take them if you break the rules. And it's not up to the rest of us to help you if you've decided you want to be helped.
By the way, yeah. G, you're more than a week into your COVID diagnosis. What's been your worst symptom?
I'm glad you asked that. I was going to say I had a little bit of a cough, but you know what my worst symptom was? Yesterday, for my birthday, your boy had a couple glasses of wine, right? So I had some wine, and I was like, yeah, it's my birthday, I'm having some wine. Man, I'm telling you, I was in bed, asleep, before 7 o'clock p.m., so COVID and wine will knock you out.
That's not news for me. That's just another evening. See you at 9.
See you guys.